Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's February 5th, 2021 program. Missing middle housing. What is it? Why do we need it? And how do we get it? This is the 19th program of our 2020-2021 programming year. My name is Scott Coltrane, and I'm the City Club president. Support for City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of the City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. Our programs are always available on our YouTube channel and on our Facebook page, and are broadcast on public radio station KLCC FM 89.7 on Mondays at 7 p.m. We have both business and in-kind sponsors, including our diamond sponsors, Kaiser Permanente, University of Oregon, Peace Health, Lane Community College, and generous support from the City of Eugene and from Lane County. In today's program, we discuss missing middle housing. Speakers include Terry Harding, Principal Planner for the City of Eugene, and two members of the Planning Review Panel, Sam and Robert. Our new City Club format will include a question and answer period with City Club members via Zoom. This City Club program is the first in a three-part series on local housing issues. In 2019, concerned about housing affordability, the Oregon legislature passed House Bill 2001, which re-legalizes traditional missing middle housing types, allowing duplexes on all parcels zoned for detached single-family residential use, and allowing triplexes, fourplexes, cottage clusters, and townhouses in areas zoned for residential use. By June 30, 2022, larger Oregon cities like Eugene will need to implement new zoning that meets the law's minimum requirements, or the state-approved model code will go into effect. But passage of HB 2001 isn't the beginning of Eugene's history with the elusive missing middle. Stroll along one of Eugene's historic streetcar lines, our earliest transit-oriented development, and you'll find duplexes, quads, and small masonry apartment buildings nestled among walkable neighborhoods and mature street trees. In 2017, the City of Eugene produced a missing middle handbook to review the characteristics of these traditional housing types, and then completed a land use code audit, which identified numerous barriers to the development of housing for all income levels as envisioned by our comprehensive plan. In 2019, participants in the city's housing tools and strategies process collectively endorsed actions to encourage more diverse housing options and creative solutions. Since then, Eugene has been on a winding path and through a global pandemic, but HB 2001 has a deadline. This program will introduce HB 2001, describe the characteristics of missing middle housing, summarize Oregon's integrated land use planning goals with emphasis on Goal 1, citizen involvement, and Goal 10, housing, and explain the innovative citizen involvement processes the City of Eugene is using to develop its missing middle code, a randomly selected, demographically representative, deliberative panel of 29 local residents. I would like to thank Karin Knutson and John Belcher for organizing and coordinating today's program. Karin, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you, Scott, and thank you to our City Club members and listeners for joining us today for this program on missing middle housing. A few additional comments, because today's program is a little bit unusual. Wanted to spend some time introducing the representatives from the Deliberative Planning Review Panel who are joining us today. This panel is a partnership of the City of Eugene working with the nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, Healthy Democracy. They worked together to assemble a deliberative panel of 29 randomly selected Eugene community members who had applied to join this process. And the two speakers joining us from the panel today are using their first names only to maintain the integrity of the process. This panel is Oregon's first lottery selected review panel on a major urban planning project, and it's one of several ways that Eugene residents will be able to participate in the local implementation of House Bill 2001. Our third speaker today, in addition to Robert and Sam, is Terry Harding, Principal Planner of Community Planning and Design Teams at the City of Eugene. And I'm going to hand it off to Terry.
Good afternoon. As Karin said, my name is Terry Harding. I'm the Principal Planner with Eugene's Planning Team and the Project Manager for the City's work on middle housing. As you just heard from Scott, House Bill 2001 was passed by the Oregon Legislature in 2019 to begin to address the housing crisis across the state. It requires large cities like Eugene to update our zoning to allow housing types that were common before World War II, but were largely excluded by zoning ordinances after the war. Since the 1950s, Eugene and many cities across the US dedicated large parts of their communities for single-family detached housing only. Roughly 90% of Eugene's neighborhoods are zoned R1, which is our low-density residential zone. This is referred to in the planning field as exclusionary zoning because it excludes anything other than single-family detached housing, with some exceptions. The middle housing types that used to be built alongside single-family homes pre-war include duplexes, triplexes, and fourplexes, which are usually attached together, homes of two, three, or four per building, cottage clusters, which are small homes grouped around a common courtyard, and townhouses, which are a group of homes attached side by side. All of these housing forms can be seen in older parts of Eugene, with a prevalence near downtown and the University of Oregon. We're also fortunate to have extremely talented affordable housing developers in our community, and they have been building middle housing for decades around the city. Check out Woodleaf Village, Turtle Creek, and Willikensy Crossing, for example. A few years ago, the city put together a missing middle handbook, which you can find on our website and includes a walking tour of the downtown Westside neighborhood. People can view all of the middle housing types from the street or alley along this route. Allowing more middle housing throughout our city as we grow can help us meet the diverse needs of future households. In Eugene, we have a growing number of smaller households, increasing racial and ethnic diversity, and a large unmet demand for more affordable housing. Homes in the middle housing range tend to be more affordable by being smaller in size and sharing walls, which contributes to energy efficiency. We can also plan for more housing options near transit corridors, helping to reduce our carbon footprint. At this point in the city's process, we're asking for public input on a variety of middle housing questions. The state has adopted rules to guide cities in updating their zoning codes. We're launching a survey that asks questions about how the city of Eugene should respond to the rules. Should we do more, or should we do the minimum to allow middle housing as spelled out by the state? Or should we do more and encourage middle housing by reducing regulations and increasing flexibility? Or should we go even further and incentivize middle housing by offering fee reductions or density bonuses, for example, near transit lines or if the homes are offered at affordable prices? We call these options levels of implementation, and the survey walks through examples of how the city could regulate things like parking and design standards at the allow, encourage, or incentivize levels. Engaging in housing policy in this new way builds on Oregon's legacy of statewide planning. Since the early 1970s, every community has been required to have a state-approved urban growth boundary and comprehensive plan, which must address projected housing needs of residents 20 years into the future under Goal 10, the housing goal. The middle housing legislation represents a pretty major paradigm shift to planning for our housing needs to meet the social, economic, and environmental challenges of our time. A total of 19 statewide planning goals provide a framework for Oregon cities to work within, starting with Goal 1, citizen involvement. Eugene's approach to writing middle housing code includes an intentional focus on equity and inclusion, and greatly exceeds the requirements of Goal 1. By limiting the types of housing that could be built in certain neighborhoods, exclusionary zoning also excluded whole classes of people, including Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and people with low incomes. Exclusionary zoning was widely used across the states and resulted in wholly segregated communities, which has been carefully documented in the 2017 book, The Color of Law. In Oregon, this history is especially harmful, as non-white people were excluded from even living in the state by the Oregon Constitution until 1926. Eugene's low numbers of community members of color illustrate that our exclusionary policies of the past have a lasting impact today. To begin to address the inequities of past planning policies, our outreach for this project includes that focus on equity and inclusion. It continues all of the traditional outreach methods, such as our website, surveys, and boards and commissions meetings, but it includes some new things too. An equity roundtable, building on the work started for the Climate Action Plan, new social media platforms, such as Huge Planning on Instagram and Facebook Live Conversation, and a partnership with Healthy Democracy, a nonprofit based in Portland, but actually born in Eugene. We are the first city, as Karen mentioned, to ask Healthy Democracy to help us engage a broadly representative group of Eugene community members to weigh in on a planning issue. The randomly selected participants were balanced across seven demographic factors. They include council ward of residence, age, income, educational attainment, race and ethnicity, experience with a disability, and whether the household owns or rents its home. The panel is like Eugene in a room, but like no public meeting I've ever attended about a planning issue. We're hearing from a variety of voices that we don't typically reach, and the conversations have been so valuable to both the middle housing work and to public engagement generally. So I'm very thrilled to hand it over to Sam, one of the panelists, to share her perspective about serving on this panel.
Amazing, thank you so much, Terry. My name is Sam, or Sammy. I use the pronouns she, they, and I served on the panel, or am serving on the Healthy Democracy panel this year for HB 2001. I joined the panel, I'm a college student. I rent this apartment that I'm living in right now. And when I received the invitation to join the panel, or potentially be on the panel, I was very enthusiastic. I felt kind of empowered by, you know, all of what it outlined and all of kind of what it pertained to. I've always been very passionate about social justice and environmental justice, and I felt that housing was a really perfect intersection between the two because it's also a disparity that I have, you know, been very familiar with as a young low-income person in Eugene. I haven't lived here for very long. I actually moved here in February of last year, so it's been almost a whole year. And so I was really interested in getting to know a lot more about the housing issues in this particular area and also in Oregon as a whole, because I'm very well aware of Oregon's racist history, as Terry pointed out and went into depth about, and also just the inequities in housing in general. I think I was like 19 when I was invited to the panel, so I'm 20 years old now. So I obviously don't know very, very much about housing. I've never, you know, even thought about owning a house, taking out a loan for a house. I've only ever rented apartments. And so at the beginning of all of this, I kind of felt as though I didn't know enough. I wasn't knowledgeable enough, but I filled it out anyway, and I heard back. And was invited to join the panel, which was really empowering, but also very scary because I was afraid I wouldn't have anything to say at all. But the lottery style way of going about it was really enticing. And I really wanted to represent, you know, young, low-income people going to college. So I remember the first meeting was a lot of information that I didn't know much about, although I'd heard about HB 2001. And it was actually really really nice to have a lot of people in the room with a diversity of backgrounds and experiences and, you know, levels of knowledge about housing and their own experiences with it. So I didn't feel very alone or, you know, unknowledgeable, I suppose. I felt like I fit for sure. We were all over the board with how much we knew, but we all had a very common interest, which was that we wanted to help other people and also ourselves and make housing more equitable, accessible, and affordable for all. So the panel has developed a number of project principles. I have only selected 10 to read off because I figured that was appropriate for the amount of time we have today. We selected these principles through a democratic, fair, all-inclusive, patient, and individually empowering group-oriented process of listening to speakers that know so much about housing in a variety of categories and disciplines, taking notes, learning a lot. Again, a lot of us didn't know a bunch to start out with, so we were very excited and enthusiastic to learn anything. And then some of us had a wealth of knowledge in certain areas, and so it was really wonderful to go into, you know, breakout discussion rooms and be able to, you know, pick their brains and then also like feel what it felt like to learn that information and then run with that in, you know, whatever direction felt right. It was very engaging, very positively affirming, very, you know, community minded, I suppose. It felt like you were a part of a huge community of people that really only had the best interest of, you know, the community of Eugene and also, you know, Oregon and even on a wider scale in mind. And that common interest, though some of us disagreed on certain things, that common interest was very exciting to be a part of and to, you know, keep in mind. And there wasn't really a lot of disagreement. Like, people have all sorts of opinions as to how, you know, we should go about things, but I thought personally that it was a very patient, very civil, very democratic process of going about deciding on the principles. We voted through like the Zoom poll feature. So we all got a say, we all felt heard and seen. And I was actually a part of the community liaison group. So I'm not sure if anybody in this room has seen the video that we created, but we also did a little bit of a like testimonial video on people's experiences, and overwhelmingly everyone felt heard. So that was really exciting to know and to see. I'm gonna go into the principles now and just give a little brief outline and maybe go into depth a bit about what they mean. Some of them are a little bit like elusive and ambiguous, but that's why we have extra information. So our number one principle, and these are organized by a number of, like, basically everybody voted and some of them, you know, were tied. And so they used a random number generator to break those ties and to figure out how to consecutively lay them out. And so the first principle that was overwhelmingly most supported was that affordable housing is of paramount importance. So rent is over half a person's income at this point. 60% is what we found, which is a lot. That's a lot of our income. So affordability must be a priority. That can keep people from affording the amount of food they need every month. That can keep, you know, families from being able to supply their children with, you know, school books and clothes and supplies. So that is definitely huge. And I, even as, you know, a 20-year-old low-income person, have definitely experienced that, you know, oh my goodness, I don't have like enough, you know, and that feeling of not having enough can be really hard and is kind of terrifying. Number two was our provision for continuous improvement of policy. So essentially what that means is what we create will need to be revisited in the future or revised. We wanted to establish a periodic form of review process on existing policy to change accordingly. And basically that would look like forming a review process that is at least as representative and as inclusive as this panel. So the lottery process was definitely part of that, and, you know, also just making sure inclusivity and accommodation and accessibility are, you know, prioritized. Number three was to expedite the process of securing affordable housing for those that need it most. We said reduce the red tape. And so basically we wanted to make sure that once, you know, we start possibly building, you know, affordable housing and middle housing, that it becomes a great priority and that we're able to make sure that happens as soon as possible. And so reducing any of the red tape that exists and trying to really push that process forward. Number four was maintaining the affordability for newly constructed middle housing when replacing existing affordable housing structures. And I think that's pretty self-explanatory. Number five is that zoning codes need to serve the needs of the general population. So they need to speak to a minimum level of habitability. And we all pretty much agreed on that, because any young low-income person can attest to the fact that we've lived in some pretty dumpy apartments. Number six, rentals need to be affordable and habitable and accessible. So that was very similar to the previous one and also self-explanatory, I think. Number seven is that we must refrain from tearing down existing habitable, affordable housing and discourage replacing it with higher cost housing. Number eight is to protect and preserve our natural resources, such as the Amazon headwaters, and features our city holds dear as well, such as open spaces, green spaces, playgrounds, and gathering spaces. We also added especially for children. Number nine is build for the foreseeable future. Age and other demographics are changing. It is important to have middle housing that can cater to an older population and people with disabilities, allowing them to live and ideally thrive. This is important because houses are often too big for one or two people. And last but not least, because there are so many priorities that we have listed, is to address houselessness or homelessness with practical solutions like tiny homes, transitional housing, and townhomes. More parks of tiny homes like Emerald Park or cottage clusters for homeless individuals, something that gives a homeless person a sense of dignity and a place that they can call their own. So the overarching goals of the panel and of HB 2001 were democratic processes, inclusivity, affordability of housing, access to affordable housing, climate change mediation, and environmentalism as a priority, and then more consolidated or dense housing, such as apartments, duplexes, smaller structures, and eventually, or ideally, housing for all. And I think that was something, or those were all things that all of the panelists shared and had in common. We just all had different ways of going about how that might look. So it was really interesting to be a part of that. And it was very discussion-based in many ways. I've learned so much by being on the panel. It was, again, very empowering. I'm gonna use that word all the time because it did feel incredible. I am a social justice activist and advocate, so it always feels good to be a part of something. It also taught me that I don't need to know everything about one thing to have a voice and affect positive change. I can go in knowing the bare minimum and rely on my community to educate me, but also to, you know, be with me in the same like space, right? We were all very, you know, similarly on the same page. We all didn't know very much. Some of us knew a lot. And so once I finally like went to the first meeting, I realized that I was not alone in that. And that feeling of, you know, it's okay. Like there are no expectations for me to be anywhere except for where I am, because ultimately I'm here to learn and make change, was very helpful and affirming and kept me, you know, calm, kept my anxiety calm, I guess. It was also very inspiring to see a democratic process like this one. I think that all of us can sort of attest back that these last few years have kind of felt like democracy is dwindling, and it's very hard to, you know, feel like it works. You know, we know it works, but it's hard to like see that in action. And so it was wonderful to, you know, amidst everything going on politically at that point and now, it was wonderful to be a part of something that, you know, really restored my faith in democracy and made me excited to get involved with other democratic processes that I know now work and exist and are really, really important to making change and actually getting the ball rolling in certain areas. I'm going to pass it off to Robert.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Robert. And I am one of the members of the deliberative panel helping the city of Eugene with the implementation of HB 2001. I've been tasked to speak on a little bit of a different tangent in this topic. And my task is to talk about the underlying structure of the process itself. So, and the wider implications of what that process can have. So today I will speak about three things in no particular order. First is the overview about the structure and the process of the deliberative panel for HB 2001. Second is my experience as a panelist and the reason I participated. And last, my thoughts about this type of approach towards community involvement and the larger implications of what this can deliver overall. Okay, so structure. There are three primary groups involved in this deliberative panel. The panel itself, composed of the volunteers, the steering committee, functioning as an oversight group, composed of stakeholders from the city council, the planning commission, planning department, Healthy Democracy, outside parties, and two representatives lifted from the process oversight subgroup of the larger panel. The third group are the moderators group, led by Lynn Davis and Alex Ranieri from Healthy Democracy. Adjunct to the project are independent observers around the world. The observers were generally not visible to us, and we were very careful not to participate at all. We also divided into task groups to perform specific tasks. As the name suggests, this group was empaneled to deliberate on HB 2001 and delivered the fundamental principles that Sam there had enumerated that will govern the implementation of HB 2001 in Eugene and the code that they must abide by. We are still in the middle of the project. In the middle of this month, actually, the panel will be reconvening to review the drafted code with an eye towards their fidelity to the principles the panel has formulated, the 10 that Sam just listed through. We will make suggestions for improvement and await the final draft from the planning department. We met first as a group on November 10th last year. The panel as a whole has met over about nine times. There were some task committee work that had to be done, so that was done offline. We are scheduled to meet about five more times. Let's see, the first six meetings were devoted to listening to presenters on a number of subjects. Some of these were touched on by both Terry and Sam. It gave us the different perspectives on the subject. It also ensured that the group would have a common baseline of understanding of the bill and the topics and issues that surround it. It was not our expectation to do a deep dive into the minutiae of the bill, but we did learn a whole lot. The next three meetings were devoted to drafting the principles submitted to the planning department to help inform the drafting of the 2001 implementation code. We completed those principles at our last meeting. Let me see, our process is iterative. I think that in itself is a wonderful feature. Iterations are necessary because we do not have often not enough information at the onset of a project to know all the variables that would give us all the meaningful conclusions that we need. We need to go forward with whatever information we have at first, and then revisit our assumptions, and then move forward towards a better outcome. True, there are traditional models that there can be used, like a town hall model, but this often devolves into rancorous and partisan discussions. The tenor of the conversation often goes to the group with the most representation, the loudest voice in the room, so to speak. I think this model provides a balanced way of citizens to participate, this deliberative model, because it's so representative of the population. And it can be an effective tool in many levels. It can be designed to be free of political interference and bias, if need be. It can be tailored towards projects, commissions, or tasks where the wider community involvement is necessary or desired. I came to this panel with my own long experience in process methodology. I have worked with technology for about 40 years, mainly in Silicon Valley as a chief technology officer, an advanced systems engineer, and lately as a consulting technology architect, helping develop ideas into businesses. And if there is an industry that relishes the pursuit of process perfection, it is high tech. A mistake can have critical or even fatal consequences. Think of the software that runs airplanes, your cars, or even traffic lights. Bugs in these environments can be very deadly. So we study process and push the limits of its mechanics. And thus far, I've been very happy with the process that we have gone through in this deliberative panel. My experience with this project has largely been positive. There were a few hiccups, as one can expect, but none that would really approach a critical derailment of the project nor dampen my enthusiasm at participating. The oversight committee and the moderators have worked hard to ensure that our meetings were free of bias towards one view or another, and not affect our discussions and outcomes. It's very democratic, as Sam had alluded to. And this was very evident in all our meetings, from the presenters that were selected, some by the panel as a group, some by a list drafted by the steering committee. We heard details about the housing situation in Eugene. I've enjoyed hearing different perspectives and learning about things from other people like Sam and Terry and all the rest of the group. And the information we heard was at times encouraging, at times depressing, and sometimes disturbing, I must admit. Some of it opened my eyes on matters that I'm not as deeply familiar with, like the details of zoning laws and how, either because of unintended consequence or coincidence or purposeful design, have devolved into mechanisms that further the machinations of systemic racism. We have all come to learn that there's a severe housing shortage of middle housing in Oregon and in Eugene. In Eugene, particularly, most of our housing is either single family homes or apartment buildings. And we are missing that middle, as Terry and Sam had mentioned, from accessory dwelling units, ADUs, to duplexes, triplexes, row houses, and courtyard apartments. Places where our residents of middle or even lower incomes can find a place to live. Most of Eugene has been zoned pretty exclusively for single homes, and HB 2000 is designed to address that, to remediate that, and in Eugene and across Oregon. During this process, we learned also how historically housing and zoning was systematically planned, as Terry had introduced earlier, to exclude people of color from neighborhoods also all across the United States, in Oregon and in Eugene. Why did I participate? For me, that is both a simple and a complex personal matter. So first, simple. Participation was to be online because of the pandemic and scheduled for evening meetings. So it was convenient, really. I mean, frankly, I did not have to travel, prepare, and devote a large chunk of time, you know, commuting. And the time actually was devoted to being in the meeting itself. The second reason is a little bit more personal, more complex. My father was a freedom fighter in the fight against the Japanese during World War II. When I was about to go to college, he encouraged me to not only pick up a trade, but go to college and become a man of letters, and attaining that to understand the meaning of freedom. See, I grew up under the iron fist of a dictatorship, an autocratic government under martial law that only wanted to perpetuate power in the hands of the very few. Now, having moved here, I was given a different perspective in the United States as a citizen. In a democracy, the other side of freedom is social responsibility. It is a cost that we must pay. And at its core, social responsibility is about caring about freedom, not just for ourselves, but for the freedom of others. And this does not have to be manifested in the grand gestures of being a president or running for Senate or whatever. It can be gestures that are simple and innocuous as innocuous to be noticed. It can be as simple as, say, lowering your voice when you're talking on a mobile phone while in a public space, for example, so that others can enjoy that same space, or looking forward to serving in jury duty instead of actively finding ways to avoid it. Or, in this case, providing any help against the war on poverty instead of fighting its victims like the homeless. It simply means that we protect the freedoms of those who cannot. A society without a common allegiance to social responsibility will face the demise of the fidelity or faith in that democracy. My participation, therefore, in conclusion, after that long list, my participation is my way of exercising that social responsibility. Now, like I said, it does not have to be this grand scale that is visible to everyone, but in the big scheme of things, what is important is our participation at any level that becomes vital to this democracy. And this is why this experience with a deliberative panel is so important, because it makes easier for people to become part of the governance of their community. It reflects in a microcosm what this American experiment we call democracy is. I think that the more it is employed by communities and local governments, the stronger we can make our democracy. In closing, I will share one last thought. We cannot have social responsibility without the ability to listen with compassion, seek out unvarnished truth, and most of all, to act ethically in our society, because these are the things that would guarantee that a democracy will endure. As my late father has drilled into me, we should not act because of some ideology of this or that, or because somebody managed to pervert a truth that we blindly follow, or for any other reason. The only reason we should act is that because it is the right thing to do. So thank you for inviting us today, and I pass it back to Karen.
Thank you so much. And now we'll begin our moderated Q&A as a part of every City Club of Eugene meeting. And our first question today comes from John Belcher from the City Club Program Committee.
Thank you, Corin. Thanks to each of you for your presentation today. I really appreciated learning more about deliberative democracy, and very impressed with the both of you and the qualities you bring to that process. I look forward to your results. But my question is for Terry. Terry, could you speak a little bit about what is given to us by LCDC and House Bill 2001? What are we required to do, and what options do we have to work with them? I know that's a big question.
Great, yes. I'm happy to give an overview and point you to where you can find more information. LCDC, the state's Land Development, Conservation and Development Commission, adopted the rules in late December, and they became effective at the end of last year. So we've had them for a little bit. We've been looking at them and comparing them to Eugene's code with the help of our consultants and our city attorney. At the highest level, the state's rules require us to update our zoning to allow a duplex on every lot within the city that allows a single family detached home. That's part one. Part two says that we need to update the zoning to allow the other middle housing types, so that's triplexes, fourplexes, cottage clusters, and townhomes, in residential areas that permit single family detached homes. And then the rules go on to define what that means. And in many cases, it's based on lot size. So we've developed a lot size map and put it on our website. So that's a resource that people in the community have to go online to the City of Eugene website for middle housing. If you Google that, it should come up pretty quickly. And you can zoom in and see what we need to do in your part of town. There are also a number of parameters for how we regulate how the housing is built. So things like parking, design standards, lot coverage, which is the amount of a lot that a building can cover, things like that are spelled out with parameters generally. So the rules say things like for a triplex on a 5,000 square foot lot, the city can require up to 3 parking spaces. So it doesn't say we have to require 3, but we can only require up to 3. So that's an example. There's a lot of detail in the rules, as you might imagine. And we just finished a run through of the rules and the model code that was also developed by the state with our planning commission on February 1st. And that meeting contains all the detail I think that people might want to know about.
Great, thank you. And our next question is from Randy Prince.
I've got a question. Well, first a challenge on this argument about racial segregation and the housing code for single family housing. I've heard this a lot. And it certainly dates back to the era of redlining. But does anybody really have evidence that now in the era of fair housing policies that there's really more racial discrimination for the purchase or rental of a single family house versus an apartment or some other form? Because the answer is maybe it has to do with income rather than overt racism. And there are places in California, for example, that have become heavily people of color, and they're very desirable places, Diamond Bar, San Marino, places like that. So if anybody's got the evidence, I'd like to hear it. My real question is, what are you gonna do to guarantee that this new housing is affordable to the average person of color or just a low income person? Number 7, the point that Sammy mentioned, said that you weren't going to get rid of affordable housing. And a lot of times, especially a lot of times, affordable housing is torn down. Maybe you get 3 or 4 units, but is there something to guarantee that the supply of housing on average will retain as much of an affordable place to buy or rent?
I think that's a question to me. I'll give it a shot. I hear your point, and the affordability of new construction is an absolute big issue because any new construction is expensive. Part of the city's work is, number one, we have 3 goals. So we want to implement the House bill. We want to further the city's work on equity and affordability in any way we can. And we want to add to the diversity of housing types across the city. So the fact that new construction might not be affordable can't stop us from implementing the House bill. So we have to do both, if that makes sense. Allow the housing where we've been directed by the state to remove regulatory barriers. So that opens up the regulatory piece. And then there's actually a piece in the law that requires cities to consider affordability policies, such as, and it gives some examples for incentives, SDC or fee reductions, or a construction excise tax. And Eugene already does all 3 of the examples, but we could increase what we do and expand those programs to middle housing as one way of trying to make the cost of housing go down. The other point I'll just make is that we're also doing a economic feasibility analysis and have invited Tyler Bump from Equa Northwest to speak to both the panel and to our planning commission and council about this issue of broader affordability, because that's very complex. And there are a lot of opinions on all sides of what happens when regulations are changed. I will say that Tyler made that statement to all 3 groups that in general, increasing supply of housing leads to longer term affordability over time in a regional housing market. And his other main point about middle housing and affordability is that it depends what you're comparing it to. So as I mentioned, middle housing tends to be smaller, more energy efficient, when compared to a standard single family detached home.
The Echo Northwest slide I saw showed that virtually all the middle housing was well above the median wage, that those particular units that would go in, sometimes replacing affordable housing, more rundown places, is not at all targeted towards the low income person unless there's a program.
That, I think, is an excellent point, Randy, and may also give us an opportunity to remind our listeners that next week's City Club program will also be focused on House Bill 2001 and specifically the issues of affordability and innovative strategies and structures to support the creation of broader affordability and affordable housing with this new law. I'll move on to our next question, though, from Marilyn Milne.
So my question is around the response and reactions from neighborhood associations and city councilors. It sometimes feels like these dictates come down from the state from on high, and then we're supposed to scramble on the city level to implement them. And while I'm very pleased that this concept spreads the responsibility and the opportunity across the state, the city's many neighborhoods, I do wonder about the concerns and opportunities that are involved in that and the reactions you're getting on the city level. So, Terry.
Great, thanks for the question. So is the question really, what are we hearing from different neighborhoods? And
And you know, the City Neighborhood Association, has that group weighed in on it?
Yeah, so one of the outreach groups that we're working with is a local partners group, and that includes NLC, the Neighborhood Leaders Council, the Home Builders, Better Housing Together, a variety of different groups that are engaged in, and really, I think stakeholders is a good description of the groups that are involved. They have met once. They will be meeting again this month as we launch another round of input gathering. We also have a boards and commissions roundtable, and that's where all of the advisory groups to City Council, so how human rights, sustainability, planning, I want to say budget committee. These are all on our website for more information. They have had a roundtable and we'll be having another one here in February. And then I want to make sure that people understand that everyone has access to this process. So every individual, every resident has access to all of the online material and access to their planning commissioners and city councilors. So we have an interested parties list. We've been hearing from folks, whether they're affiliated with a group or not. And the opinions are, at this point, mostly questions, actually. Questions about what is required and what can we do with that? Like how wide are the parameters? Which we're just starting to dig into.
So you don't have any specific responses or formal reactions yet? Or do you that you can share?
No, well, I don't think we have meeting summaries from the groups that met in the fall, which were reported back to the Planning Commission in December. And really what staff did with all of that input, because Healthy Democracy, all the roundtables, are advisory groups to staff. And so they submitted, in Healthy Democracy's case, they submitted a report with 41 principles in it and rationale for a lot of them. The other groups were staffed by planning staff. And so we took notes during the meetings, summarized what we heard. And then taking all that information together, staff produced a short list of what we call values and principles to guide the project. So those are included in our presentations to Planning Commission and Council, but they're summarized from all of the input that we've been hearing.
I will interject a question that came in from a City Club member, and a reminder that any City Club member can submit a question to be asked on one of our programs. This question, I think, is also for Terry, but I would be interested to hear if either of the members of the deliberative panel learned anything about other case studies in the process as well. And the question is Oregon alone in making these housing policy changes, or are any other communities around the country doing similar things? And if so, what can we learn from them?
Yeah, there is definitely a lot of interest in zoning reform broadly and in allowing more types of housing in formerly single family neighborhoods specifically. This was most visibly demonstrated in the city of Minneapolis several years ago. They launched a comprehensive plan update that actually was focused on racial justice and undoing the legacy of exclusionary zoning. That was an important guiding principle for them. And since then, Oregon's law was heavily influenced by what City of Minneapolis was doing. We are the first state to implement a requirement like this for all cities to update their zoning. And very recently, City of Sacramento in California has granted every single family lot, or formerly single family lot, the right to build four units. So fourplexes they've legalized in their single family zones, and also eliminated parking requirements in the same action. And that was unanimous. So that's a fairly big zoning overhaul.
For me, one of the things I found, just to speak about what we found out that's been part of the deliberative panel, it goes to your question, Karen, was touches both the affordability of the housing and learning the many intricate details that go into the economics around pricing in a neighborhood. But I think in my own research, one of the things that I found truly interesting was the impact of the financialization of the real estate market of houses being traded as REITs, for example, have a real impact on the affordability of a neighborhood. The presence of the ownership, say, of a number of houses within a neighborhood will tend to have an effect on the price and affordability of the houses around that. And, you can never, in an open market, it's difficult to guarantee a certain level of affordability. You have so many forces acting around that you really, it's a fool's errand, if anything, to guarantee that, you know, this will be X amount of dollars only. You cannot, you simply cannot do that. It's the market forces and the other parts of the economics of this thing is just too large to handle. So that's what my takeaway was from that, at least that portion of the presentations that we've had.
Thank you both. Next question is from City Club President Scott Coltrane.
Yes, so I want to start with a question for Terry. You mentioned that income was one of the criteria for selecting the review panel. And in the presentation that I watched, they didn't mention income. That seems a little complicated. So if you can say how that worked. And then I'd like to hear both from Robert and Sam, how having such a diverse group has impacted, and Terry too, has impacted the outcomes. Do you think it really fundamentally changed the process? 40 years ago, when I was a city planner for a short time, it was all vested interest, neighborhood groups, developers, things like that. And so my sense is this is very different. So if you can speak to that, that'd be great.
I'll say a few words, and I'd love to hear Robert's perspective of being in the room with the panel, because city staff is actually not on the panel. We're apart from it. We're not in the small group conversations. We're unaware of the conversations that actually happen within those small groups. So I'd love to have Robert talk about that. My understanding, and Healthy Democracy staff ran the complete recruitment process. They have the algorithms that sorted people and random generators to pick people in different categories and then balance them, and lots of rules around if a person was the only one in a particular category, that numerical factor was doubled so that you wouldn't ever have just one person from a category in the room. And that was an intentional part of their process. The income was self-reported. So when the recruitment letters were sent out to random addresses, there was a form to fill out and it boxes to check on what your household income is. I think I'll stop there and let Robert.
Okay, thank you, Terry. The way I got into this, I understand about 7,000 plus letters were sent out by Healthy Democracy. There was a number of responses, and from that, you had to fill out the form and fill out some of the statistics that would break us out into the proper demographics. Initially, I was supposed to be a backup, and somebody had backed out of the project, so I was put in. And coincidentally fell into the process oversight committee just purely by happenstance. As far as the discussions, it was really interesting because it wasn't that we were divided into permanent groups. In fact, we were inserted into different groups almost every time. And subgroups, I should say, within the larger group. And the division was such that you could bring in, you would discuss the topics that the presenters had just given and exchange the ideas around that. So for six meetings, actually, we would have a presentation and then break out into the smaller groups, discuss what we heard, exchange ideas, and learn more. The later three of the meetings was when we actually formed those principles. Part of that was the discussions around poverty, social justice, activism. It really spanned a broader spectrum, which I think was due to two things. One was the implicit placement of rules that had rules on behavior for the group, which was you have to be civil, you have to disagree if you do, and then create this environment of open exchange. But I think the second one is that the more diverse perspectives you have within the discussion and honor the diversity within that discussion, the more productive that discussion becomes. So a real common tenor of conversation and comment, actually, that I've heard during each one of these subgroups is how wonderful to hear from the other person's point of view. And I think given the diversity of income, you know, and all the demographics that you can name, only contributed to that productivity.
If I could just add one more thing about that, we, as you said, Scott, we hear often from vested interests, and we need to, like, we need to hear expert opinions from builders and affordable housing developers and people who have expertise, and they are part of the project. But what's new about this is bringing in the random panel and also the equity roundtable that I talked about to elevate and raise voices that have been missing. And so absolutely it's having an impact. It is influential in staff's preparation of the principles that I talked about. When I mentioned the levels of implementation, that comes from not only Healthy Democracy, but several groups we met with mentioned we should really go beyond the minimum. We should go beyond the minimum and do more to try to make things affordable and do more to help people and really meet the needs of the community. And so that's where that idea came from.
Thank you to our speakers, Terry Harding and Robert and Sam from the City of Eugene's Deliberative Planning Review Panel, working on the implementation of House Bill 2001.
This has been our February 5th, 2021 program, Missing Middle Housing. What is it? Why do we need it? How do we get it? Before we proceed, I'd like to recognize our Diamond sponsors. Kaiser Permanente exists to provide high quality, affordable healthcare services and to improve the health of our members and the communities we serve. More information at www.kp.org. Support comes from the University of Oregon. Since 1876, UO has helped Oregon's question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information at uoregon.edu. Peace Health is proud to serve Eugene, Lane County, and beyond. As your hometown healthcare partner for more than 80 years, our mission is to keep you and your family healthy. Learn more at peacehealth.org. Lane Community College transforms lives through learning. LCC provides comprehensive, accessible, high-quality educational opportunities that promote student success. For more information, visit lanecc.edu. I would also like to acknowledge our gold sponsors, Pacific Cascade Federal Credit Union and Dr. Sandy Ibarra Hearing Associates. Before we thank our speakers today, there are a few more quick announcements. Thank you to our in-kind sponsors, KRVM 91.9 Radio, Pack Info and Simplified Computing LLC, Dot Dotson's Photography, and a special thank you to public radio station KLCC FM 89.7 for airing City Club programs on Mondays at 7 p.m. Our programs are always available on our YouTube channel and on our Facebook page. If you're a City Club of Eugene member, you can ask a question at future taping of our programs. If you're not yet a member, you can join and then participate. More information is on our website, cityclubofeugene.org. Next week, our Friday forum is another on housing, Delivering the American Dream, Housing Affordability in the 21st Century. This program is part two in a three-part series on local housing issues. More details and information about future programs can be found online at the City Club's website, cityclubofeugene.org. Now I'd like to give a generous thanks to today's speakers for a great program. Terry Harding, Sam, Robert, and Karin, thank you for an illuminating presentation. This concludes today's program. Be well and stay safe.